Hello, this is Talking History. My name is Andy Pfeffer. I'm a professor of history at Union College in Schenectady, New York. And today we are going to be talking about the anti-nuclear and peace movements, the history of it, with Professor Larry Wittner. He is a professor of history at State University of New York at Albany, in Albany, New York. And he's going to talk about his new book, Resisting the Bomb, 1954 to 1970, a Stanford University Press book, which is the second volume in his series, The Struggle Against the Bomb, a three-volume series, a three-volume history of the anti-nuclear movement, the world anti-nuclear movement. And Professor Wittner is going to be at an author's reception in Albany, New York, at the Bookhouse in Stuyvesant Plaza. That will be on February 21st from 2 to 4 p.m. to celebrate the publication of this book. Paperback copies will be on sale there. There will be a book signing. And that is, as I said, Saturday, February 21st at the Bookhouse in Stuyvesant Plaza in Albany, New York. And for those of you who aren't in the Albany area, you can ask your local bookstores for The Struggle Against the Bomb, and either the first volume or the second volume, and this volume is Resisting the Bomb. It's in paperback, or you can call 1-800-872-7423 to order it. So, with me is Larry Wittner, and we will be joined by telephone shortly by Dave McReynolds of the War Resisters League to talk about his participation in the anti-nuclear and peace movements. He's a longtime peace and anti-nuclear activist. And then later in the hour, we'll be joined by Professor Ursula Franklin from the University of Toronto, a participant in the Canadian anti-nuclear movement. Both of them were active in the anti-nuclear movement and the peace movements during the 1960s. So, to start, I have Larry here. And Larry, welcome to Talking History.
Thank you, Andy.
And I think probably the first thing to do here is to ask you how you came to write this book, how this all started for you.
Well, I suppose it started during my childhood. I remember in school wearing a metal dog tag that was distributed by the authorities in the New York City public schools, which I attended. And the dog tag was designed, I was told, to identify me after nuclear war, probably to identify my charred remains. Also, we practiced bomb test drills. We would hide under desks when our teacher would suddenly interrupt our math problems and say, take cover, and we'd scramble under our desk to hide from the bomb. And I remember not finding this entirely encouraging at the time and wondering what was going on. I didn't do anything about it until I was a college student at Columbia College, and the Soviet Union had resumed atmospheric nuclear testing on September 1st, 1961. And I saw a sign up on campus advertising a demonstration down in Washington, D.C. To picket the White House and urge the president not to resume atmospheric nuclear testing as the Russians had. And so I went on that demonstration with my college roommate and a busload or two busloads of students. And I remember picketing in front of the White House and carrying a sign saying, don't mimic the Russians, which I thought was a clever slogan and a good one. The president at the time seemed to stubbornly ignore my advice and that of others, but protests against bomb testing grew, against the nuclear arms race, and later against the Vietnam War. I found this kind of protest appealing and very interesting. So when it came time to write my doctoral dissertation in history, I did it on the history of the American peace movement since 1941. And in later years, I've continued to be fascinated by the issue of bringing in to one of humanity's oldest, deadliest, and most disgraceful habits, war. In 1986, having written a number of works on the subjects of war and peace, on history of U.S. foreign policy, I began to work on a history of the world nuclear disarmament movement, a work that has expanded, as you mentioned, into a three-volume work called The Struggle Against the Bomb. Volume 1 appeared in 1993, and Volume 2 has just appeared, and it covers the years from 1954 to 1970.
So this was in many ways a personal sort of interest for you that started you off, coming from the experience of having been there when bomb testing was occurring and when the hysteria about the bomb was affecting Americans in general?
Yes, it tended to interweave with my life, and I think with the lives of many people. In fact, when I mention some of these childhood experiences, they often tell me about theirs, at least those who lived through this period, and want to talk about this sort of thing. I think it made a major impression on me and on millions of other people at the time, some of whom, at least, became activists against the bomb.
How were your views affected by doing this history? You started off by having a personal interest and a political interest to some extent, but how was that affected? How was that integrated in the doing of the historical work?
Well, I began by assuming that the struggle against the bomb had failed. The reason was that I began it in the late 1980s. And at that time, this country and the world had just seen a mass movement unlike any probably in world history, with millions of people turning out in the streets, protesting against the nuclear arms race, calling for banning the bomb. And public opinion polls showed that most people approved of this sort of stance. That is, they were concerned about the nuclear arms race. They did want the bomb to be banned. They at the very least, wanted to freeze the arms race, and at most, wanted to get rid of nuclear weaponry. And yet, it seemed that the governments of the world challenged in this way, certainly the nuclear powers challenged in this way, managed to hang on to their programs. A new generation of missiles was put into place in Europe. The arms race moved forward in the United States under the hawkish Reagan administration. And therefore, in spite of this tremendous stir among the populations of the world, little seemed to have been changed. The old game went on. So I had a very pessimistic view, and I wanted to understand why this seeming mass movement, or this mass movement that seemingly had tremendous public support behind it, had failed. Gradually, though, I began to see that this kind of all-or-nothing approach missed some very important developments. The advent of nuclear arms controls and the unwillingness of nations to wage nuclear war again, since they had done so, or at least since the United States had done so, in 1945. And this, I realized, was a major change. And after intensive research in the records of hundreds of disarmament groups and formerly top-secret government files, I reached a startling conclusion that the world nuclear disarmament movement had played a crucial role in curbing the nuclear arms race and preventing nuclear war.
Maybe we're going to move to Dave McReynolds in a moment, but maybe before we talk to him, it would be a good idea for you to give a brief synopsis of what the book covers, and what is the history we're looking at here?
Well, in fact, what happens is that beginning with the catastrophic U.S. nuclear weapons test of 1954, when radiation went far beyond the testing site and radiated Japanese fishing boat, the Lucky Dragon, and Marshall Islanders, and U.S. Weather station personnel very heavily, and millions of other people around the world on whom the nuclear fallout subsequently fell. After this, a dramatic protest movement began to develop. Groups like SANE, the National Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy, Women's Strike for Peace, the Student Peace Union, and pacifist groups such as the War Resisters League, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom developed in the United States. Groups like the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, the Committee of 100 developed in Great Britain. Groups like the Voice of Women emerged in Canada. The movement against atomic armaments in France surged forward, and comparable groups developed around the world, not in as massive a form, for example, in communist countries, but nonetheless began to develop there as well. Individuals, especially scientists and intellectuals in the Soviet Union and other communist bloc states, also began to protest against nuclear testing, and to demand nuclear constraints on the Soviet Union and indeed on all other countries. These individuals and groups helped to mobilize the public against nuclear tests and nuclear weapons, thus helping to stigmatize the bomb, helping to make it politically unacceptable as a weapon of war. The governments of the nuclear powers and of their allies were horrified by this upsurge of protest and sought to control and to contain it. But ultimately they failed. As their secret planning meetings revealed, they ultimately found it politically impossible to wage nuclear war. Furthermore, although they remain unwilling to go as far as to ban the bomb, they were forced to take the first steps in this direction. An atmospheric test ban treaty signed in 1963, a nuclear non-proliferation treaty, an anti-ballistics missile treaty, and other constraints on their nuclear options. Furthermore, dozens of nations around the world, either individually through their decision not to develop the bomb, countries like Switzerland, countries like Sweden went through dramatic controversies about this question and made a decision not to build the bomb during these years. Or other countries that decided to sign on to the Non-Proliferation Treaty voluntarily renounced the bomb. And this, I discovered, was due to popular pressure. And therefore, while the movement did not succeed in its goal of banning the bomb, it did succeed in helping to curb the arms race and prevent nuclear war.
So a popular movement emerged in the late 1950s and early 1960s that was fairly effective in limiting the ability of governments to proliferate nuclear weapons and to test them, it sounds like.
Well, and to wage nuclear war.
And to wage
yes.
nuclear war. And
yes.
we have them to thank for that.
Yes.
Okay, well, let's then turn to someone who participated in building that movement. We have on the phone Dave McReynolds of the War Resisters League. Hello, Dave. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Welcome to Talking History. I have Larry Whitner here with me, and we're talking about his book, Resisting the Bomb, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit and have you talk to our listeners about your involvement in the peace and anti-nuclear movement back in the 1960s and what sort of experience you had doing that, and how, especially how the War Resisters League was involved in building that bigger anti-nuclear movement, which Larry is arguing was successful in limiting the ability of countries to wage war and to wage nuclear war.
Well, I think that the situation was always very complex. I think Larry is correct that we had an impact on stopping the expansion of the nuclear arms race. And if you leap way ahead, I'll go back to the 60s, but if you leap way ahead to the Gorbachev period, I've always thought that Gorbachev's Helsinki pitch to Reagan on nuclear disarmament was based in part on his acceptance of an independent peace movement in the West that he could not control, but that he felt would act as a brake on the West, and that would allow him to take certain initiatives. So I think that in a real politique sense, it played a key role in Gorbachev's decision. If you go back to the late 50s, when the civil defense drills were started, and people may not even remember what we're talking about, but there was a time in New York State when you had to take shelter or face a year in prison. I had to take shelter for like 15 minutes once a year when the sirens blew and the shelter was going to protect you if the bomb went off. And the Catholic Worker and the War Resisters League were arrested in 1955, about 26 people, I think, in City Hall Park. And that was, for us, the beginning of the opposition to the nuclear arms race. Our own position was never stop the testing. It was get rid of the weapons altogether, which is one reason we were able to survive the partial test ban treaty that Kennedy and the Russians signed, which in our view was a treaty signed in order to permit them to continue to develop nuclear weapons underground and to miniaturize them and perfect them. But there was, here I'd be curious to know how Larry feels about this. If you go back to that time, we were still very much in the grips of McCarthy. And one of the things which had a real impact was the civil rights movement, which in 1955 legitimized public mass opposition to something, in this case, the race laws in the South. I think a lot of whites felt that if blacks could do that, they had the right to raise questions about nuclear tests. And those questions originally were not deeply political. They were entirely around health questions. Mothers who were afraid to question government policy for fear of being called communists could say, and did say, my children's milk is radiated, and I want the test stopped. And I think this was the beginning of a movement that ended up questioning American foreign policy. But the Cold War was very, the Cold War and the McCarthy period made it very hard for us to have a free and open debate here until the civil rights movement. And from that point on, I think there was an ability on the part of the white community and liberals to begin to develop. In 1957, you had the voyage of the Golden Rule into the Pacific, where the pacifists sent a boat out into the test area and risked their lives. The boat was stopped, but another boat continued, and that was seized. You had the efforts to climb over the fence of the testing sites in Nevada and elsewhere. You had the mass movements organized by SANE, Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy. You had huge demonstrations in that period. I remember in Times Square we had a police riot when they attacked our crowd, but we got thousands of people within 24 hours of the last U.S. test, atmospheric test. We had said we would come immediately after the test, and we did, and there were thousands of people. We blocked Times Square, not with a dozen or 100 or 500, but with 5,000 or 10,000 people, which is very hard to think of today when we're sort of paralyzed watching Clinton move us toward a pointless war with Iraq, and no one quite knows what to do or whether we can be heard. And I do have to feel, watching the Iraq situation, that the American public is about as powerless to change policy as the Iraqi public is to change Saddam's policy. But at that time, I think that the movement was able to raise both the questions of the morality, which is what the pacifists were trying to raise, of incinerating large numbers of people, and also the questions of the logic of it, and or the reasonableness of it. And I think we were effective right from the 60s through the 70s into the 80s, when there was a resurgence of the movement starting in Europe and spreading over back over to here, and climaxing in the enormous demonstration in 1982 in Sheep's Meadow in New York, where we had about 1 million people.
Larry, how do you view that what Dave said about the impact of the civil rights movement and how that encouraged the anti-nuclear movement and pacifist movement to reemerge in the late 1950s?
Well, I think it was very encouraging. Sometimes people looking back on that period focus on the civil rights movement and seem to forget about the fact that there were two great mass movements of the time, and those two great mass movements were the civil rights movement and the anti-nuclear movement in the late 1950s and early 1960s, and some of the same people were involved in both movements. And no doubt the civil rights movement played a major role in shattering the climate of Cold War repression that held down the struggle against the bomb. But I think the reverse is also true, that increasing popular dismay and protest against nuclear testing also paved the way for the civil rights movement. So I think they were useful to one another in that sense, and indeed that's why many people were involved in both movements. Together they altered the climate of conformity and fear that had characterized the early 1950s, and by the early 1960s, the way was open for substantial changes, not only in the kind of Jim Crow system that had existed in large parts of the United States, but in the way governments had comported themselves when it came to nuclear weapons.
In the emergence of this movement, there are many groups that that were involved, that participated. And Debbie Reynolds, if you could talk a little bit about how those groups came together, what groups are doing what, and how did they work together to shape a movement of this sort and of this size and impact?
Not always easily. I think it would be easy to gloss over the turbulence, the infighting, the struggles, and to sentimentalize the great mass movements of the people as if they were not characterized by deep and often bitter disagreements. One of those was the position held by the War Resisters League that anyone's nuclear tests were wrong, including those of the Soviet Union or China. The Communist Party, while not significantly large, was a significant player in the peace movement at that time, and it was not willing to accept that position. So you had one set of tensions running there between the people who felt the Soviet Union was a bastion of peace and those of us who really felt very deeply that there were no such animals as good nuclear weapons and who had never seen a good war, including World War II, which we can argue about some of the time as a necessary war, but it was never a good war. And so that was a division. Then you had ego trips that are not even worth going into and could consume whole books all by themselves as to who was going to be top dog within the movement. The miracle is that a citizens' movement was able to develop, despite this, in Europe and in this country, in which the so-called professionals, and I say here that people like the staff of the War Resisters League, played a role, absolutely, but in which large numbers of people who were not professional organizers at all and who didn't have, quote, hard politics, close quote, rose up and became very key because you had a mass movement. And when you have a mass movement, a genuine mass movement, leadership which is difficult is thrown aside and new leadership is created. And if you're asking about the players, finally the church got involved, slowly, but it got involved. You had a Catholic peace movement that emerged, which was very new. The whole question of Catholicism and questioning the state was unheard of when I came into the radical movement in the 1950s. You never saw a Catholic, except for the Catholic worker. You never saw a Catholic involved in the socialist or pacifist movements. But then suddenly by the 60s and 70s, you had quite a significant Catholic left developing. And I don't mean just the Barragans. I mean bishops and cardinals had begun to question the institution of war. Certainly the Protestants were. So all of these moved together to become players in what was an extraordinary mass movement. And I think, in fairness, one should add that there were elements within the military who were always on our side and elements within the political establishment who were on our side who felt trapped, unable to move, and who were very grateful for the demonstrations in the street because it allowed them to have a dialogue inside the establishment that could not have taken place if we had not been outside in the street.
This sounds like a fairly democratic organization to the movement in its largest kind of picture. Does that fit, Larry, with your sense of the history of how these organizations came together and the different facets of the movement work together?
Yes. I think Dave's quite correct when he talks about the conflict between communist-led peace groups and non-aligned peace groups, as the non-communist ones were called and were, in fact. I think, though, within the non-aligned camp, and certainly for the United States, that was the vast bulk of peace groups and peace activists, they worked together very well. There were tensions, there were ego conflicts at times, but in general, the War Resisters League could turn out at the same demonstrations that Women's Strike for Peace turned out at, and SANE came to, and the FOR came to, and so on. So they worked together fairly well, and rather than they're pulling in different directions, they reinforced one another and developed a critical mass against the bomb. It's also true that certain new constituencies were being brought into the movement, such as women and students, that would serve as a harbinger of later movements and protests.
The only thing, Larry, that I would say is that you should have been in on some of the negotiations between SANE, Women's Strike, WRL. It was like high diplomatic stakes to arrange the speakers, the line of march, who would have what would be on the leaflet. And oddly, early in the Vietnam War, when it was no bigger than a man's fist on the horizon or cloud, whatever the phrase is, when there were a dozen wars like it, and the Socialist Workers' Party had adopted that as their big thing, and they were focusing on that, and they were correct, as it turned out. We nearly had a fist fight because they wanted to have the Vietnam signs in the march, in the Easter march, and that would have driven out SANE, which was opposed to that. We really had, yes, it worked, but the diplomacy, the meetings, the agreements were fascinating to watch.
This was also part of the unfolding of the emerging student movement in the 1960s.
It was, and you had something which no one had foreseen, and whether it was the use of LSD or whether it was simply the fact you had a huge bulge in the number of kids relative to the whole population that gave us a youth movement. And I was already, relatively speaking, an old man by then. I mean, if I'm 68 now, I was no child, and things broke out in the 60s. I was already part of the old left, and it was certainly fascinating to me, who had never expected to see really a mass movement in my lifetime, to see this movement emerge. And it was a youth movement which was unhappily, and we tried to say this to them at the time, and we didn't have an audience, I'm afraid, that their hostility to the working class, to the trade unions, to the Archie Bunkers of the world, was going to isolate them, as it did. But my God, they were wonderful people. The early 60s were a wonderful time. It was wonderful to live through them, and to have been there.
Okay, thanks very much. Dave McReynolds from the War Resisters League has been talking to us about his experiences in the peace and anti-nuclear movement in the late 1950s and 1960s. Thanks very much for joining us, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to take a brief musical break, and then when we return, I'm going to be back here with Larry Wittner to talk about his book, Resisting the Bomb, 1954 to 1970, Volume 2, in the Struggle Against the Bomb, a three-volume history of the world anti-nuclear movement. And we're going to be joined by Ursula Franklin, a professor at the University of Toronto, who was an activist in the Canadian movement against the bomb. And so we will now go to Malvina Reynolds.
Just a little rain falling all around, the grass lifts its head to the heavenly sound. Just a little rain, just a little rain, what have they done to the rain? Thank you. just a little boy standing in the rain, the gentle rain that falls for years, and the grass is gone, the boy disappears, and rain keeps falling like helpless tears. And what have they done to the rain? Just a little breeze out of the sky, the leaves pat their hands as the breeze blows by. Just a little breeze with some smoke in its eye. What have they done to the rain? Just a little boy standing in the rain, the gentle rain that falls for years, and the grass is gone, the boy disappears, and rain keeps falling like helpless tears. And what have they done to the rain?
Welcome back to Talking History. My name is Andrew Pfeffer. I'm a history professor at Union College in Schenectady, New York. And today I have with me Larry Wittner, whose book Resisting the Bomb, 1954 to 1970, has just come out, Stanford University Press. And Larry and I are talking about the anti-nuclear movement, the world anti-nuclear movement in the 1960s and 70s. And we were just speaking with Dave McReynolds of the War Resisters League about his experiences in the anti-nuclear movement, and we're about to move on in a few minutes to talk to Ursula Franklin, Professor Ursula Franklin at the University of Toronto, who was in the Canadian movement. But before we do that, I want to talk to Larry a little bit about the international character of this movement. This was an international movement. It started in some ways in Japan, didn't it? And then it gained momentum in Europe as well as in the United States.
Absolutely, Andy. The movement was really worldwide. Groups in Japan took up the struggle against the bomb, particularly after the disastrous nuclear tests of 1954 at Bikini. Groups in Great Britain, like the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, groups in the United States, like the National Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy, groups in Canada, like the Voice of Women, and the Canadian Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, were very much involved. And as I mentioned, there were even nascent groups of anti-nuclear dissidents in communist bloc nations. So yes, it was a worldwide movement, and as I mentioned, it had dramatic effects on the nuclear policies of the great powers.
Well, how did that affect the American movement, the American anti-nuclear activists? Was there a lot of contact between Americans and Europeans and Japanese? Was there a lot of sharing of political views and discussion on the question of nuclear war, or information for that matter, about nuclear testing and nuclear development?
There was a great deal of communication. Speakers went from one country to address another country's rally or marches. The Aldermaston marches in Great Britain, held at Easter, mass marches that went on for days against the bomb, spread around the world, including to this country. The peace movement symbol that we know today, the circle with the line down the center and the two little lines going off to the side, was developed for those Aldermaston marches, but spread around the world to this country and to Canada.
I'd like you to speculate a little bit on why it is that an international movement like that could emerge. Was there something that had happened in the world, or was it simply because nuclear warfare was such a evident threat to people? Were they were they simply responding as one would expect people to respond, or were there other factors involved? Now, McReynolds mentioned the baby boom and the emergence of a new generation of activists. Did that have an impact in other countries as well?
Well, I think it did, but I think the major factors were the development of the hydrogen bomb, which was 1,000 times more powerful than the atomic bomb, and the testing of those hydrogen bombs that so dramatically gave evidence not merely to the radiation that was now drifting around the world and causing untold suffering and genetic damage, but serving as a harbinger of the nuclear holocaust to come. And this mobilized people and caused them to break out of their normal everyday lives and begin to take to the streets in protest.
It seemed that a lot of the impetus, a lot of the momentum initiated or was initiated in countries that were particularly at risk, for instance, Great Britain or Japan, but also in non-aligned nations, that the non-aligned movement, nations that were neither aligned with the East or the West, had an impact or were very important in the emergence of the international anti-nuclear movement.
Well, I think a great deal of protest took place in all sorts of different countries. But in terms of popular sentiment and what the polls show us, the greatest resistance to the bomb, the greatest hostility, came in the non-aligned nations, the nations of the emerging Afro-Asian bloc of the time, whose leaders, such as Nehru of India, or Sukarno of Indonesia, or Nkrumah of Ghana, served as eloquent spokespersons condemning the leaders of the nuclear powers for their recklessness in pushing this nuclear arms race forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have Professor Ursula Franklin on the phone from Canada to talk to us about the Canadian anti-nuclear movement. Professor Franklin, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you. I heard what Larry said. And I'd like to add something to that and to your question on why that happens. And I think it has something to do with the nature of radioactive pollution, because in previous wars there was always that possibility of neutrality, that there could be innocent bystanders, other nations who said, this is none of our business, you have it out. What became very clear once the nuclear bomb was used is that that notion of innocent bystanders was gone. The consequences of an action of one nation state was felt not only for the present but for the future internationally. And the international consequences of national action in future made that movement, I think, very different, because it was not only to stop something in the present or immediate future, but it became very clear, and I think this is one of the reasons why it were women who carried that internationally as the Canadian Voice of Women, was that what was at risk in terms of radioactive pollution was the health of future generations.
Now, you participated in the Voice of Women organization in Canada?
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, Voice of Women was formed in the early 60s directly in response to the resumption of atmospheric tests, when Canadian women, together with women anywhere else, said, we cannot allow this nonsense to go on. It pollutes the atmosphere to an extent that it will affect our children. Never mind ideological differences, nuclear war is not a way to settle them. and those in power have a responsibility, and we are going to remind them of it. And whether that were women strike for peace in the States, Voice of Women as a strong and powerful organization in Canada, going to their governments as well as to the public and pushing for that thing that eventually happened, the ban on atmospheric tests, which was only the first step to a nuclear disarmament movement. But the tools that we used were primarily those of stressing the responsibility for the future. And out of this came the campaign that I was particularly involved with, but certainly not alone, and it wasn't the only one I was involved with. That is the collection of baby teeth, because around that time in 1963, young children who lost their milk teeth were essentially the last generation of babies that had grown up without fallout. And it meant that collecting those teeth would allow scientists and people who would follow, particularly the strontium 90, that was bone-seeking and would affect bone and health, to have a baseline of those never again baby teeth that came from children that had grown up and whose bones and teeth were formed without fallout. And we set us about collecting those, which indeed we did in a very major campaign, and there are still people, grown-ups now, who come to me and say, you know, I went around with a button that said, I gave my tooth to science. It was an incredible educational campaign, quite apart from doing something pretty useful. It meant going into schools, going to mothers, really making it clear what nuclear testing was all about.
So the baby teeth campaign was not only a useful campaign in order to collect information about nuclear fallout, it also became a tool for building a community of activists?
Very much so, because in fact it didn't it produced the baseline for collecting information. We were after kids who hadn't grown up under fallout, but it was a political campaign in the sense of allowing information, good, solid scientific information, and I'm a physicist by profession and a professor in the Faculty of Engineering at the University of Toronto. It allowed that sort of leveling of information to be disseminated where it was most needed, on the grassroots level of young women, where it went into the families, into the schools. And it was produced a loyal, strong, and politically very discriminating opposition.
Now, you are a physicist, and you are a pacifist as well. But it sounds to me as though the participation in the anti-nuclear movement also involved a participation in something that sounds like an emerging feminist movement in Canada.
Very much so. It was in many ways the training ground in which young women, first of all, got together, learned things about about organizing. But then when their voices were heard much less than they felt they should have been, when the government was at best lukewarm, there was an emerging political consciousness raising that said, is that because we are women? Is this because we are anti-American? Is that because they think we are dumb? And so it was a very good and solid training ground, and in fact many of the women who got their first exposure to public issues then went on to become human rights commissioners got into the feminist movement, but also into community organization. And much of the ecological movement found its leadership there.
I should just add that having looked at U.S. government records, I was struck by the fact that in meetings with the Kennedy administration, John Diefenbaker and other Canadian political leaders showed how frightened they were, how chastened they were by the protests of the voice of women, and complained to Kennedy that while they would like to move forward with the emplacement of nuclear missiles on, nuclear warheads on Canada's missiles, they couldn't do so, that the public wouldn't stand for it. And
yes.
Of course, in 1963, as you know, there was a very dramatic political campaign in which Diefenbaker was effectively pushed by groups like the Voice of Women and other anti-nuclear groups in Canada into actually standing up against the United States and its demand to accept these nuclear warheads.
Yes, you're very correct. And it was when Pearson, who replaced Diefenbaker in the subsequent election, when he was a liberal, very much more congenial to some of the Voice of Women members, and whose wife, in fact, was a member of the organization, was sufficiently pressured to change his stand on nuclear warhead-capable missiles being stationed on Canadian soil. It really rocked the organization, and Mrs. Pearson had to publicly resign from it. But the political factor was beyond that of being an anti-nuclear movement. It became an extra-parliamentary opposition. It was a stronger opposition in many cases than the opposition in the House of Commons, and the opposition in the House of Commons in turn fed on the citizens' politics.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Franklin, for joining us. And that was Professor Ursula Franklin talking to us from Canada here on Talking History about the Canadian anti-nuclear movement. Larry, do you have anything to add to Professor Franklin's remarks on Canada and the international emergence and emergence of an international movement or its connection with that?
Well, just in terms of Canada, what's striking is that while Pearson did succeed Diefenbaker and on a pro-nuclear platform in 1963, he recognized the extent of anti-nuclear sentiment in Canada, that it had denied him a parliamentary majority, and therefore began to back away from his pro-nuclear stand, just as Diefenbaker had done before him. And when he was succeeded by Pierre Trudeau as Prime Minister from the Liberal Party, Trudeau began to move Canada out of the ranks of the nuclear nations, and today Canada is a nuclear-free nation. So there, as well as in other countries, I think we owe a great deal to the people who opposed nuclear weapons and saw to it that the arms race was stopped in its tracks.
Well, this might be a good opportunity to talk about a little bit about the consequences of the movement and what this has all meant for subsequent generations, and what impact this movement had on history. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think specifically what this study means is that we survived the era of Cold War nuclear confrontation of the 1950s and 1960s, what seemed to be and was a very dangerous time with nuclear threats and counter-threats. with vast H-bombs exploding in the atmosphere, with the prospect of nuclear war looming before the nations of the world. We survived all this not because of nuclear deterrence, not because the bomb in itself prevented other nations from waging nuclear war, but in large part thanks to the women and men who stood up and said no to nuclear weaponry. Or to put it somewhat differently, if one's going to look at the history of nuclear arms controls and nuclear restraint, one has to say that it's impossible or to tell the history or write the history of nuclear arms controls without the nuclear disarmament movement is like writing the history of civil rights legislation without the civil rights movement. The movement was central in this story and helped to prevent nuclear war and the onrush of the nuclear arms race.
Now the movement didn't operate without opposition, as I understand it. There was some government response and government action against the movement, and as our conversation with Professor Franklin indicated, that was also of international scope, involving other countries and other countries' governments and Americans' relationship with other countries' governments. So what did the peace movement meet in terms of government opposition and opposition from those people in power in various nations who had an interest in nuclear proliferation or were committed to it for some one reason or another?
In general, the nuclear powers and their allies in their defense pacts met the anti-nuclear movement with tremendous hostility. Frequently, this simply meant that they would be denounced and belittled by national leaders, that vast public relations campaigns would be launched to sell nuclear weapons to the public as vital to their national defense and encourage the public to believe that nuclear testing was not at all harmful. Some, like scientist Edward Teller, said it was actually good for people. But on a more hostile level, it sometimes meant imprisonment of the movement's leaders or repression. I was struck during my research in Great Britain, for example, when I was sitting in the public record office and going through one folder of the Prime Minister's records, Harold Macmillan's records, labeled Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. And I wondered what was going on in terms of the British government and that movement. And as I started going through the folder, I realized that the Prime Minister, or the document showed that the Prime Minister was meeting with high-level officials from his cabinet, the Home Secretary, who was comparable to our Attorney General in the United States, and other cabinet officials, and they were mapping out a campaign against CND, how to destroy its credibility, how to mobilize people on their side of the debate, how to keep CND leaders off BBC broadcasts and get their own people on, and so on. I didn't find a discussion of any illegal activities there, but after I finished with this particular folder, I went back to the finding aid showing the various files that the government and the Prime Minister had developed, and I noticed that the three following this folder were all marked closed for the next 100 years. And that's very rare in terms of British government records, which usually open up after 30 years, as the records were open and I was looking at. So I think if the government was closing off things for the next century, there were probably some pretty nasty things going on that the government simply didn't want researchers like myself or anyone to learn of. We do know, for example, that the leaders of the Committee of 100 that were organizing demonstrations of nonviolent civil disobedience at U.S. Air Force bases, bases that had planes armed with nuclear weapons. These leaders were arrested and sentenced to jail terms of up to 2 years.
To return to where we started, we're going to need to wrap up, but we started, you know, with your personal involvement and personal interest in this, how this all began for you, and I think I'd like to ask you about the, you know, commitment to peace studies that is involved in the doing of this work. You're part of the peace studies, the group of historians that do peace studies in the United States and internationally. What is peace studies exactly, and what is the purpose of it? What kind of relationship do you see yourselves, you know, in with history, or what kind of relationship do you see between your personal commitment to peace and your professional interest in being historians?
Well, in 1964, a group of historians, some of them quite eminent, got together and formed the Conference on Peace Research and History. This group soon expanded into an organization of several hundred scholars who were trying to apply their historical talents to dealing with the problem of war. In this sense, they were doing something rather different than most historians do. They were actually attempting a kind of problem solving, using whatever expertise they had to deal with what they viewed as one of the great plagues of modern times. Most of the time, historians don't do this sort of thing. They're not supposed to be committed to any aim or any goal. But in fact, scientists don't believe that at all. It's not looked at askance when a scientist, for example, seeks a cure for cancer or a cure for AIDS. And in that sense, we didn't find it improper to be looking for a cure for war. So we were trying to mobilize our rather minimal talents, whatever skills we had, to look at this question of war and peace and see what we could do in the balance. Let me return briefly, though, to the point I was making in terms of the book, namely that more generally than I've outlined here so far, popular pressure does work. It's not all powerful, but it does seem to have an effect. And along those lines, let me return briefly to the anecdote I began about at picketing at the White House against the resumption of nuclear testing back in the fall of 1961. You'll recall my seemingly futile picketing around the tree in front of the White House there. In the early 1990s, some 30 years later, I was back at the Kennedy Presidential Library in Boston doing research for this anti-nuclear project, and I was reading an oral history interview with Adrian Fisher, who was deputy director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency during the Kennedy years. Fisher was explaining the curious fact that after the Soviet government had resumed atmospheric nuclear testing on September 1, 1961, the U.S. government didn't resume until April of 1962, nearly 8 months later. He wrote that Kennedy thought, quote, that it probably made sense to resume testing, but he also recognized that there are a lot of people that were going to be deeply offended by the United States resuming atmospheric testing. We had people picketing the White House, and there was a lot of excitement about it. Just because the Russians do it, why do we have to do it? Unquote. And Fisher concluded, quote, that's the reason we didn't resume atmospheric testing. I thought at the time of our seemingly useless picketing and know that we had made a difference, at least some difference. So, in short, I think citizen activism does make a difference, and I think scholars can show what difference that might make and help to light the way thereby to a better future.
And so we come full circle from the beginning of a historian's career with personal commitment and
the culmination of it with personal commitment through the writing of history. I've been talking with Larry Wittner, the author of Resisting the Bomb, A History of the World Nuclear Disarmament Movement, 1954 to 1970, Volume 2 in the Struggle Against the Bomb, put out by Stanford University Press, Larry Wittner's three-volume history of the world anti-nuclear movement. And we were joined earlier with Professor Ursula Franklin, the University of Toronto, a participant in the Canadian anti-nuclear movement, and Dave McReynolds of the War Resisters League, who was a participant in the 1950s and 60s in the American movement. And those of you who are interested in ordering copies of Wittner's book can call 1-800-872-7423. This has been Talking History. My name is Andy Pfeffer, and thank you for being with us.
Into plowshares.